This recording is produced from Open Rail Tapes, originally recorded for Vancouver Community College, Langara Campus, in 1973. This program forms part of the Langara College Real History Project, which restores and preserves British Columbia's oral history. This project is funded in part by the British Columbia 2000 Millennium Arts and Heritage Fund, in partnership with Vancouver Public Library and Langara College. Copyright for this product is held by Langara College. It may not be reproduced in whole or in part, in any form, without permission from the copyright holder. The title of this recording is Native Artists. The interviewer is Marcel Bezik. The interviewees are Bill Reed, Bill Lightbone, Tony Hunt, and Clarence Wells.
This presentation is divided into four parts. The acknowledgments, the exordium, the interviews, and the conclusions. First, my acknowledgments. There are a number of people to whom I owe a debt of thanks for their assistance in preparing this project. First and foremost, there is Mrs. Pat Wall, who has been an undying inspiration. She has chased and coaxed all and sundry Native artists in an attempt to get them to allow me to interview them. At a time when I felt that I would never interview anyone, she managed to get Bill Reed to invite me to his home to be interviewed. And so it has been all along. She has taken such a great interest in this project that I must in truth say that it is half hers. Also to be thanked are the five subjects who allowed me to interview them. First, there was Bill Reed, who is an established artist, doing in silver and gold things full of awe and wonder, in the traditional Northwest Coast designs, contemporary European designs, and combinations of the two. Mr. Bill Lightbone, who is co-manager of the Killsleigh Gallery in the Royal Center, is a willing and free speaker on any aspect of Native life and an authority on Haida art. On another occasion, when I was in Killsleigh, I interviewed Mr. Lightbone's stepson, who specializes in the carving of argillite. Mr. Tony Hunt, who is an outstanding Kwakutl wood carver, operates the Arts of the Raven Gallery in Victoria, as well as a school for carvers. I apologize for the quality of reproduction in the portion of interviews involving Mr. Hunt. I have decided to use this interview despite the poor quality of the tape, because I felt that what Mr. Hunt had to say was too important to be left out for technical reasons. I hope Mr. Hunt will understand and that you, the listeners, will bear with me. The last artist who I interviewed was Clarence Wells, who I believe all of you know, or at least are aware of his seriographic work. Unfortunately, a large portion of that interview was technically unusable. Special thanks go to Mrs. McLaughlin for numerous trips to the Audiovisual Center and for constant encouragement. Also, thank you to Miss Margaret Copeland for obtaining tapes of Dan George and Native music from the library of the School Broadcast Division of the Department of Education. The project started out as an anthropologically orientated study of Northwest Coast Indian art. However, after I commenced my interviews, I realized that the word traditional in describing this art was not really valid. That Native artists, like artists all over the world, will not be bound down, and the spirit will free itself. The muse will express herself. I approached the subject in a rather scientific and not exactly artistic fashion. I sought out a number of things among the various artists, such as how long they had been practicing artists, what training they had received, what mediums they worked in, what their favorite medium was, what they thought the difference was between Indian art, that is, Northwest Coast Indian art, and art of the Western European tradition. I sought out answers to questions like, do you feel that traditional Northwest Coast Indian art was so tied into Indian religion and social usage that it can no longer be handled in the same manner that it had in pre-white days? What had the introduction to white man's tools and materials and methods done to native art? I wondered how the native artist felt about himself in relation to the white artist. Was he an artist or was he an Indian? Was there such a thing as Indian art or native art, or was it just art in part of a worldwide scheme? How did they feel about whites who practiced traditional native art? Did they feel that they were practicing the same art as their ancestors had done in generations past? Were they trying to do that? And if they were trying to do that, did they feel that they were achieving that? I wondered how they felt about white dealers. And I wondered who they considered the greatest native artist. There is one final point I would like to stress. This is a survey of contemporary artists, a very limited survey, and it does not in any way attempt to trace the history of native art. It is an examination of individual artists and their backgrounds, and I only incidentally touch upon the development of native art and its social function. It is more interested in what makes the individual artist tick and what he believes in than in the social function of artists.
Charles Edenshaw started learning and studying the art form from the time that he was 5 years old, and he was expected to be an artist. Now, the fact that he developed into an exceptional artist has no bearing on it. This was a way of life. Certain people were trained to be artists, or whatever it was they were trained to be, from an early age. Certain ones developed better than others, and of course these are the ones that became outstanding. Well, we don't have that opportunity today. Those that are working in the art form just stumbled into it by accident, or because they were very interested in that particular type of thing, and they just maybe took a whack at it and found that they could express themselves in the art form, and these are the people that are in it today. So it's a different type of system altogether. Well, in those days, if it became apparent after a few years of training, now, as I say, a lot of them started at the age of five. By the time they were 10 years old, I think it would be apparent to everyone whether this person was ever going to be good enough in art. We're speaking now strictly of art. If he was going to be a good enough artist to continue to work at it, and if not, then of course he took on other areas of responsibility. He would then maybe, for instance, take to hunting and give up his art background, and then it would become the responsibility of some other member of that particular family who possibly was showing responsibility as an artist up to that stage.
What if you were not born in the position of becoming an artist in a lower class and you showed artistic ability? Would it be encouraged?
Oh, yes, very definitely. There's in the history of the people, there are quite a few instances where exceptional artists did come from various other classes who were not expected to work in it traditionally. There's a story that most people know, that anyone that has studied the Haida history of the artists knows about, what the heck is his name now? He was the one that they called the cripple anyway. He was a slave. He was a slave boy. He was born into slavery, I suppose, in the village. But the fact that he was a cripple meant that he wasn't capable of doing other things. And as a consequence, he was given the opportunity to work in the art form, and he actually did work with Charles Edenshaw. And he developed into an exceptional artist. He's one of the better-known artists from the times of the Haidas. As a matter of fact, there's been some suggestions that there was a competition between Edenshaw and this other fellow. I know his name as well as I know my own. It's just skipping my mind at this particular time. At any rate, he contributed a great deal to the art form at this particular period of history, which is somewhere around 1850 to about, actually he died fairly young. He was about 37 when he died. So I imagine 1887 or somewhere around that period of time he died. But he was an excellent artist, and his work is secondary only to Edenshaw, as far as I'm concerned, and I think that this is the opinion of most students of Haida art. So, yes, very definitely, there were a lot of artists that were developed from other strata of society.
What about women? Did they become artists?
Well, in the old, traditionally, no. No, there were no women artists in the sense that we think of artists. The only way that they could apply any feeling for the art was in the making of garments and in the making of baskets. Now, this was traditionally a woman's job, was the making of garments and baskets, which includes their hats and this type of thing. Now, men never ever did make hats, for instance, and yet I think we're all aware of the beautiful hats that are in the museums all around the world. So in that sense, they worked in the art form, but they were restricted to this type of thing. They were never given the opportunity to express themselves in the other areas of the art, which is like the carving of wooden totem poles and in argillite and, you know, this type of thing. Of course, we have a different kind of a situation today. Just the other day, we were going through the shop, and it just tickled me. We have about 8 or 10 very outstanding pieces in that shop. And out of that 8 or 10 pieces, 6 of them were done by from various different women, and they're excellent works. So it's an indication of the change in the times. Of course, my wife, Levina, is an excellent artist in her own right. And it's a different time. It's a different time now. I think it's only right that if women have the ability to do these things, that they should be given the opportunity to do them. After all, the ability isn't restricted to men only. If it's there, it's there.
That was Bill Lightbound describing the choice and training of artists in traditional society. The following speaker is Tony Hunt.
Listen, I've been a professional artist, I guess, since 62, so that's 11 years. And that's when I started with the museum. Before that, I served a 10-year apprenticeship under my grandfather, so I've been really doing what I've been doing for 21 years.
Do most native artists practice under established artists, first of all?
That's the old school way. You know, there are, I call it the old school way now because people really don't have just one apprentice. You know, they learn their craft and that's about it. You know, it's really only advance what they know. Like, I learned the old school way by learning under, I think, a master carver, and because I grew up with him.
You mentioned the old school and the new school. What is the new school?
New school is what I'm doing now. I'm teaching sometimes too many people. You know, like at one, like I have a shop, you know, one time I had 10 guys in the shop, and I was roughly teaching them all, you know, and in a sense, they're all teaching each other, and I'd show one person, like John, for example, and if I wasn't there, he could show them how to draw the eye design or whatever. You know? That's the new school, and I also teach at most of college, you know, like a regular art course of designing and everything. You know, that's the new school thing. And with 18 students, and last year, 27 students.
How do you determine who becomes a student?
Well, this is just, I mean, there or in the shop or where?
In the shop.
Just who's ever interested. You know, and if they're interested, then I'm interested in teaching them. If they're not, then they really don't stay that way.
In the old school, did the teacher have one student for a number of years?
I think in the old days, they served about a 10-year apprenticeship, what I did. And they stayed with the master carver until he knew as much as he did. Because when my grandfather died at 85 or 87, I was only 19, but at 19, I could design as well as he could and carve as well as he could. And I knew as much as he, you know, about design, and I didn't know the stories, you know, that they wondered.
I started out interviewing Bill Reed by asking him how long he had been a professional artist, what his artistic training was, and let the interview go on from there.
I don't know whether I'm an artist or not. I kind of like to think of myself as a honest tradesman. And I've been doing it full-time, first as an employee of the University of British Columbia under a Canada Council grant, and then later on my own for about 15 years now. And before that, I was pursuing the jewelry end of it anyhow as an avocation, part-time occupation, for about 10 years. So I guess it's nearly 25 years altogether that I've been doing this part-time or full-time. Well, I didn't have very much artistic training of any kind. My training consisted mainly of going to a jewelry school in Toronto for 2 years, where I learned European jewelry techniques, and later on apprenticing for a year in a platinum and diamond factory in Toronto. And then I just developed that on my own. As far as the learning Ida designs is concerned, I learned them from books and museum pieces and so on. I had no direct contact with the tradition as it was handed down within the Ida culture, because by the time I came on the scene, it had just about died out. My grandfather was one of the last silversmiths, and there was very little carving going on at that time, and I didn't know him very well. I never lived in the villages, or either of the villages. And as I say, the artistic culture had just about died out among the Haidas by the time I started doing it. So my knowledge came from No, it seems to have started in Alaska. But I don't know very much about that aspect of the jewelry making among the native people of the West Coast. But as soon as they began getting coins, they didn't have any use for them as a medium of exchange, so they melted them down and made jewelry out of them. And that started probably about the middle of the last century. And there wasn't very much of it done. There were only a handful of men who ever made bracelets. And that's all they ever made was bracelets and a few other pieces. And it was made both for trade with the white men, also for their own use. One of the last things that they made for their own use, I suppose. They were given as engagement presents to women in the, up until fairly recently. And strangely enough, gold bracelets were made almost exclusively for Indian use because the white people didn't think it was worthwhile tying up the gold in that kind of thing. So they would give the native jeweler silver coins, American silver dollars for the most part, and he would melt them down, beat them out, and engrave them, and sell them to the curio shops, or sometimes he would be commissioned directly by somebody to do them. The gold pieces, however, were done, as I say, mostly for the use of the people themselves.
Did you hear something called silver carving?
Well, it's pretty well engraving. It's I think you can find examples of European work that would be called engraving that follows much the same technique. They did scoop out areas and so on. It was done out of flat pieces, and the basic techniques were line engraving and crosshatch texturing, and a certain amount of actual carving. But the metal they worked with was never more than a millimeter thick, so there wasn't a great deal of relief carving done in this fashion.
What do you do with this?
Well, I've done in the Haida work, I've done silver and gold, as you say, and slate or argillite, as it's called, wood, ivory. And I've used abalone shell and as inlay in jewelry. And then I've done silkscreen prints and some metal engravings for printing. And, I guess that's about all. Some drawings.
What did you say
is your favorite? Well, I like gold, I think. I make more money doing gold. It's also a very nice material. I mean, you know, there's a real mystique about gold. It's nice to work with it. Oh, I don't know. In some ways, but the difference is very slight.
You had
a
necklace,
I was in Japan, and it's it doesn't really matter. It's also in it's my exhibition piece on display in Toronto too at another show. It was I got a Canada Council grant in 1968, and went to England to work and then really to work on non-Haida design. And this was a piece that I made under the sponsorship of the Canada Council. And I've still got it and display it here and there. It's, what did you want to know about it? It's in the non-Indian tradition, and it's made of gold and has some diamonds in it, and it's related remotely in my mind, at least, to the Haida work, because they didn't set little things like the impossibility of having two objects occupy the same space stand in the way of doing exactly that, and to go into how they got around that little problem would be hard to describe verbally. But the idea behind this necklace actually is to make two necklaces which would be related as far as design is concerned and would actually occupy the same space. And now this is very difficult to describe. You'd have to see the necklace to see what was going on. But it's actually one necklace made of solid gold sheet formed into geometric forms, and then another necklace made of fine gold wire, and two of them coexist in the same form, and then the diamonds are